Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is former manager of the Police and IRS Records founder, Miles Copeland. But first of all, if you're a YouTube creator and have a YouTube channel, you probably got an email just this past week from YouTube. What was inside was their new terms of service, and buried in the middle was something that said, guess what? We're now going to put ads on every single video, whether you want that to happen or not. Now, up until this time, there's only two ways that a video could be monetized. Either you became part of the YouTube Partner Program, and what that meant is you had at least 4,000 viewer minutes in the last year, 1,000 channel subscribers, no copyright strikes, and an AdSense account. And then what would happen is you would be able to monetize a video or not. The other way, of course, is if you happen to use some copywritten material and the copyright owner found out, they could then place an ad on your video, whether you wanted that to happen or not. Well, now guess what? Every video is going to have ads on it. For many YouTube channel owners, many YouTube creators, they feel that they don't want advertising because it deteriorates the user experience. That may be true, but the fact of the matter is, now it's going to be on every single video, whether you like it or not. Now, why did YouTube do this? Well, the biggest reason is their ad rates are down about 50% since the beginning of the pandemic. So this is a way for them to make up the revenue by simply having more ads. The other thing is it does force people to subscribe because now it's easier to pay $9.99 a month and have no ads at all than it is to see the ads all the time. So we'll see how that works. Either way, you're better off to actually sign up for the partner program and at least make a little bit of money rather than having YouTube take it all. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Don't forget about my online courses on mixing, production, branding, and music business success at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Also, get an expert analysis and objective opinion of your songs and mixes as a member of my Hitmakers Club. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Now, if you're a Mac user, you've probably noticed that in the last week, Apple has come out with its brand new computers featuring what they call the M1 silicon chip. This is a system on a chip which makes everything a lot more efficient and therefore a whole lot faster. I just ordered one of these, but it won't arrive for at least a few weeks, but I'll give you a full report when it does come in. In the meantime, if you've really looked at the specs, you saw that it includes several Thunderbolt 4 ports. And you may think, wait a second, what is this Thunderbolt 4? Well, if you've been a Mac user for a while, you don't have to worry so much about it because all it meant is Thunderbolt 3, Thunderbolt 4 are pretty much the same in that the entire feature set of Thunderbolt is included. However, if you're a PC user, this does make a difference because up until now, PCs were only using a little bit of the feature set of Thunderbolt. So you were never exactly sure if you're going to be able to get everything that's involved with it. Now, Thunderbolt, of course, has a high speed, but it also allows you to chain multiple Thunderbolt peripherals together, as well as a number of displays. What Thunderbolt 4 really means is the entire feature set is being used. So for a Mac user, Thunderbolt 3, Thunderbolt 4, pretty much the same thing. For a PC user, Thunderbolt 4 means now you get the full package as opposed to before when you didn't. Oh, but there is one more thing that you do get with Thunderbolt 4, and this is for Mac users as well. Up until now, one of the big problems and big complaints about Thunderbolt is there were no hubs, so you weren't able to expand your ports at all. This has now changed with Thunderbolt 4 because with the brand new operating system, OS 11 Big Sur, you're now able to incorporate a Thunderbolt hub as well, expanding all your ports. So that's a cool thing with Thunderbolt 4. So look for it on your next computer. My guest this week is Miles Copeland, who managed the Police and created IRS Records. IRS was at the forefront of punk and new wave as the home of bands like R.E.M., The Bangles, Dead Kennedys, The Go-Go's, and many others. He also managed Sting in his solo music and film careers. The son of one of the founders of the CIA and a mother who worked for British intelligence, Miles and his brothers grew up in the Middle East, which greatly influenced his openness to new music. He now owns and operates Copeland International Arts, which features musical styles from all over the world, including the Middle East, world music, Irish, tango, flamenco, and Polynesian. In part one of the interview, we talked about Miles growing up in Egypt and Lebanon, getting involved with the upstart punk scene in London, behind the scenes at IRS Records, hearing the Police's Roxanne for the first time, and much more. I spoke with Miles via phone from his home in Los Angeles. Were you aware of what your parents did for a living?
Well, remember, when I first went to the Middle East, I was, age four or something, and I left when I was age six. So at the time, my father was the CIA station chief in Damascus. And at the time, there wasn't even an embassy there. It was one step below an embassy. It was called a legation. And he was the cultural attaché, which was his cover. But the reality was that and people always imagine that the CIA is some sort of, you know, secretive thing, and that everybody that works for the CIA is some sort of spy or something. But that really isn't the case. The generals knew my father was working for the U.S. government, and that to them was an advantage because a lot of these governments want the U.S. government to know what they're doing and what they're up to because they don't want the U.S. government to make a mistake. You know, so when my father was in Cairo, for instance, Abdel Nasser, who was the president of Egypt, knew he was CIA, and actually had requested the CIA to send an intelligence officer who could help him design his own CIA. And that was my father. So the local governments knew that he was actually a CIA operative. Not everybody in the country knew, obviously, but certainly the people that needed to know in the Syrian government and later in the Egyptian government, they did know that he was CIA. So I, as a kid, didn't really know what he did until I was probably 12 or 13. And, you know, by which time I knew he was something important in the U.S. government, because at our house in Cairo, for instance, the president of Egypt would come and visit every now and then. So, you know, if the president of the country comes to visit you, then obviously your father must be somebody important. Although I was told at the time that he was helping the Egyptian cotton industry sort itself out. But it did expose me to a lot of the sort of the issues that he was dealing with and that the leadership in the country was dealing with. Excuse me. I remember very vividly my father saying to me once that the vice president of Egypt, who at that time was called Zakari Mahedin, had complained that his people didn't want enough. And that might sound strange, but it was what he was saying was that when they increased wages, absenteeism went up. Because the average Egyptian was thinking, well, if it takes me, you know, 20 pounds to live for a week, and I have to work 5 days to get the 20 pounds, I'll work 5 days. So if they raised his salary so that he could now earn that same 20 pounds in 4 days, he figured, well, I'm not going to show up the fifth day because I don't need that 20 pounds. So, you know, in America and the West, we always imagine, you know, you increase wages, you'll get more out of the people and all that. Well, in Egypt, it was absolutely the opposite was the problem, you know. So I was dealing with certain things like that I sort of learned at a young age that, you know, what we imagine happens in the West doesn't necessarily happen in some of these other countries.
Well, you were young, as you said. Did the music make any impression on you?
Well, at the time, you know, as an American, you're very conscious, I think, maybe even more so than if you're an American growing up in, you know, Des Moines, Iowa or something, okay? You're where everybody around you is an American, okay? They may be a different color than you, or they may be a different, you know, they come from a different background than you, but basically they're all American, okay? when you're growing up in Egypt or Lebanon or Syria or some other country over there, you're very aware that you're an American and therefore you're different than everybody, almost everybody you see around you. So I think probably what affected me most was, you know, I was exposed, for instance, to Arabic music, but I didn't really think a lot about it because I was an American kid. So I was interested in, you know, Elvis Presley and Little Richard and, you know, the Big Bopper and all those sort of, you know, bands that were coming along, you know, the Buddy Holly and whatever, you know. And then later on, of course, it was the Beatles and whatever, you know. So I think growing up overseas, you, as an American, you probably gravitate more to your country's music than you would necessarily do if you were growing up in, you know, closer to America, and unless you weren't exposed to it, you know. I must have subliminally heard Arabic music every time I got into a taxi or I was walking down the street, you know. So it was there in my head, but I was not something, I mean, I wasn't going and buying Arabic music when I was young. It wasn't until I was in college and at the American University doing my MA degree in Beirut that I actually went to a couple of concerts where they were Arabic artists. And the reason I did that was because my best friend was the ambassador, the son of the Egyptian ambassador, and he was always invited to see Fairuz or one of Sabah or one of the famous Lebanese singers, and I would tag along and I'd say, what the hell, you know, and so I would go off to one of these sites and I'd listen to a concert, but I never really thought a lot about it at the time. But I did get exposed to the music then, you know, but I wasn't really an avid fan until much, much later.
Well, I want to get into that, but let's go back first. How did you get into the music business?
Well, sort of a long, convoluted story, but it was basically, here I was in doing my MA degree at the American University of Beirut, and my youngest brother, Stuart, who later on became the drummer of the Police, shows up, and he, for some reason, got into drums. And he came to visit me with my mother in Christmas of 1967, the local American group at the high school got themselves a gig at the university, and their drummer had gone home for Christmas, so they were drummerless. So they asked Stuart if he could sit in with them. And, of course, Stuart invited me to see the show, and I went with my friend, who was the Egyptian ambassador's son. We went to see this little group playing in this little nightclub thing where they got a gig, you know. And there was my little brother playing drums up there, and so something must have hit me, you know, and the idea that, you know, maybe I could be closer to music other than just sort of a fan buying the records, you know. Well, a number of months went by, and that group came to see me again. This time their drummer had returned, and my brother Stuart had gone back to London. And they came and see me, and they said, look, they got a gig at the university, and they wanted to do something special, and would I help them? And I said, well, what the hell, you know, so I did. And I had some black lights and some fluorescent paint and whatever, and we said, well, let's do what we've been reading about in the papers about, you know, this psychedelic stuff that's happening in San Francisco. Let's do a psychedelic event at the university. Well, of course, I had no idea what that meant, and either did they, really. But we passed around, you know, the fluorescent paint, and next thing we knew, the kids all got crazy, and it was a lot of fun. And then the group said, well, we want you to help us at every other gig we do, you know. And then a Lebanese promoter, how he heard about me, I have no idea, but I guess he heard about this concert, and he came to see me and said, well, I'm bringing a British group. Would you come and help me and put on a show, you know? And so I said, well, what the hell? And next thing I knew, this British group arrives, and they're playing in one of the hotels in the mountain during the summer. And I was helping them out, and it turned out to be a group called Rupert's People. And this was in 69, and then when I finally graduated, I went to London, and when I went through London, they came to see me and said, well, we want you to be our manager. I was like, what are you talking about? I have no idea about music, you know. And I was in Beirut, for Christ's sake. You know, what do I know about their record business or the music business? They said, well, you know, you helped us out, and we think you're the right kind of mentality, and you should do it. So, cut a long story short, I said yes. But, of course, there was a little bit of an interim because I got drafted, reported for duty in Virginia, and was one of 2,000 who got rejected. And flew back to London and went into the music business. So it was literally kind of a fluke, you know.
Did you win a promotion or as a manager?
A manager.
Ah.
I went in and I was managing Rupert's people, but I said, look, guys, I really know nothing about the music business. So I need you guys to help me, you know, educate me as to what it's all about. So their idea was, well, they'll take me around to some clubs and I'll meet, you know, promoters of the clubs and I'll see what the scene is, basically, you know. And when I went to this club that was not near, you know, was fairly near the residence I was staying with my parents in London, I met a group which became Wishbone Ash, which was the first group I really managed, because the Rupert's People guys all had jobs and they weren't really going to quit their job unless they had something definite. And I was, what did I know, you know? Whereas Wishbone were already a professional group trying to make it happen. And all they needed was some help getting a guitar player because their guitar player quit. And I said, well, I'll help you. And they became my first official management group. So, you know, basically, it was something I'd never planned. I'd never thought about being a manager, you know, until Rupert's People came to see me in London in 1969 and said, well, we think you should be a manager. And I had nothing else to do. And, you know, I thought I was going to be in the Army for 2 years. So I had no plans. So it was basically, all right, what the hell? Why not? You know, and next thing I knew, I was in the music business.
Okay, so you're managing, and then you get into the record business as a label. What brought that on?
Well, that happened a little later on, obviously. You know, well, I mean, one of the things that happens when you're in the music business in one form, you tend to grow, and, you know, one of the first things you learn is, you know, a group wants to get a record deal. So you make a record deal. And then they want to tour the USA. If they're a British group, they want to tour the USA. And so you start doing tours. And, you know, so one thing tends to lead to another, leads to another. There have been a lot of managers who have ended up running record labels. You know, the road managers become record label heads and, you know, down the line. So, you know, it's something where you kind of gravitate towards it. So at one point I was managing groups and, of course, I was trying to get them record deals. And it became obvious that, well, it's much easier to get a record deal if you're also the record company. So, you know, once you've got a bit of some credibility and you've got a couple of successful groups or something, you can go to a label and say, well, I want to start a record label. And you know, they'll be interested in you because you seem to know what you're doing and maybe you can bring some acts in. And so I made a record deal with RCA in the beginning, and it ended up, you know, later on with A&M, you know, when I started IRS Records. But basically, I think in the music business, you sort of start at one end and you could end up in another end. You know, I mean, I've seen road managers that become managers. I've seen people who are publicists become record company heads. I've seen, you know, it's something where there is no actual training that you go to. You don't go to college to learn how to be in the record business. So, you know, the record labels are looking for people who seem to have their finger on the pulse. And, you know, this publicist seems like he knows what he's doing, or this manager or this agent, whatever. And, you know, so if you decide, well, you know, getting a record company is a good way to get your acts recorded, well, that seems to be an obvious way to go.
Let's jump ahead to IRS. Did you form IRS specifically for the police?
No. IRS, what actually happened was I did a major tour in England in 1975. It was kind of like Lollapalooza before Lollapalooza was invented. It was a festival tour because I had acts that were very good live, but they never really had hit records. So I figured the best way to make acts happen would be to let people see them live and build their base that way. And so I created this sort of a moving festival tour. Well, it was a financial nightmare. And I ended up basically losing everything. I lost, I mean, I almost went bankrupt. And the only thing that kept me from being bankrupt was going to everybody and saying, look, if you bankrupt me, I'll pay, you know, you're going to get nothing. But if you give me a couple of years, I'll pay you half of what I owe you, you know, and I won't go bankrupt. And everybody agreed. So it just so happened that at the same time as I was going through this horrible financial situation where I was literally every act that I was working with pretty much left because I had no money anymore. But the punks were happening, and of course, nobody paid attention to them. So the fact is they didn't have money either. And they were interested in somebody paying attention to them, and I had no money, and nobody was paying attention to me either, but I knew the business by that time, you know. And so I kind of gravitated to work with some of these punk bands. And, of course, it was the time of Sniffing Glue, the little fanzine, and then, you know, you could put out your little single, and there was people would buy the single, so I started making singles. I did the Police single. I did, you know, the various groups I was working with, and I was putting these little singles out. So I started a record label, a whole bunch of record labels in England, really, which were little independent labels, you know, and it was really fly by the seat of your pants, you know. And I had intended to record the Police, and actually had made a deal with a studio that they said, look, for £1,000, we'll give you a month in the studio. So I decided that, you know, what the hell, I'll record the Police. And when I went into the studio and I heard Roxanne, I realized that, you know, this was something special. And even though the group didn't recognize the song as being special, I did. And I said, guys, this is a classic and it's bigger than I can handle. And I'm going to take it to A&M Records, who is a company that I had got to know because I had signed Squeeze there. And I took the record to them and made a deal. And that started the ball rolling with the Police. And eventually A&M Records in America got behind the band, and I mean, as history knows, the Police became a, you know, pretty big happening group, you know. And as they were happening in America, I started having a lot of these bands that I was working with in England sort of saying to me, well, you know, what about us, Moles? You know, you got a Police happening, and what about us? We want to go to America too, you know. And so, I had these groups wanting to get their records out, and I was thinking, well, you know, if I go to Jerry Moss with Chelsea and with some of these, you know, the Cramps and some of these other wild groups I was kind of working with, he's going to look at me like I got two heads, you know. So I went to Jerry Moss and I said, look, Jerry, here's the deal. You know, we're doing pretty well with the Police, okay? And I've got a lot of these other bands too that I was working with, you know, with the Police back in England, and they want to get their records out in America too. But, you know, so let me give you a proposal. You give me a record label, okay? And you can decide, you can let your people decide how many records they press. They can go to the market. They can advise you, look, you know, only press one copy, or, you know, press 20,000, whatever the number is. You guys decide. It's in your control, okay? And I don't need your money. So I'm going to give you those records for free, okay? But you have to put everyone out. So you have to go to everyone. You have to go to your salespeople, and they have to go out to the marketplace to see what they can sell, okay? Wow. But I'm not going to ask for your money. And at the time, of course, I already had a lot of these records recorded, so I didn't need the money. And also, there were a lot of British acts like the Buzzcocks and whatever who couldn't get a record deal in America. So if I went to them and I said, guys, I'll put your record out in America, but I'm not going to pay you in advance, or I'll pay you a very small advance, most of them went and said, well, if I get a record out in America, you know, let's do it, you know. So I managed to sign the Buzzcocks, I think, for $20,000 or something, you know. Wow. A lot of other bands I got next to free, you know. So Jerry says, well, sure, I'll give you a label, but let me listen to the records. And I said, that's the one thing you can't do. I'm not going to let you listen to the music, because I knew if he listened, he would say, well, forget it, you know, because Jerry Moss listening to the Cramps, or you know, Kelsey, or the Models, or you know, Cortinas, whatever. He's going to look at me like I'm crazy, you know. So he said, "Well, okay, what the hell, you know?" And I think for him, the hook was that, well, I didn't need his money. He could, his people could decide what they were going to press up, so they weren't going to press up records that they didn't think they could sell. So the risk for him was pretty negligible, you know. And that was really the hook that led him, made him say yes, you know. And that was sort of a lesson I learned. It was the same lesson I learned with the police, is if you make it easy for somebody to say yes, likelihood is you're going to get yes as an answer, you know. Because remember, I had offered the police to A&M in London. And my pitch to them was, look, I have nothing to recommend this band. There's no press, there's no tour, there's nothing. But the music's great. So here's the deal. It's yours. The record's yours. Cost you nothing. Just put it out. And now listen to the record. And the A&R guy, you know, was probably listening to the record. And now all those normal things that are into somebody's mind, like, you know, what's this going to cost me? You know, what's my boss going to say? Suppose it's a dud. Is it going to eat up my budget that I've been given this year to be able to sign bands? If it's all the sort of things that are going to operate into somebody's head in terms of signing an act, if that's all eliminated, where the only thing left is the music, then I think that's probably the only record that guy ever listened to that he was only listening to the music. And he liked the music, you know. What's not to like? You know, it was the police, you know. So I said, look, it's yours. You don't have to negotiate. Just give me the highest royalty that A&M pays. Record's yours. Done. Deal's ready. It's yours, you know. And so he went up to his boss and said, look, I got this free record, and it's pretty good, and what the hell? So that's how I got the police deal, you know. If I'd asked for money, I'm pretty sure he would have said no, you know. Well, the same goes for Jerry Moss and Iris Records. If I'd asked for money, I think Jerry would have wisely said, well, no, you know, because I got to take his hard-earned money that he earned from the Carpenters or Peter Frampton or whoever, and he was not going to give it to me to put into these nutty groups, you know. At least he would have thought they were nutty groups. I didn't, but he did. So that's how IRS started. It was basically under pressure from the British groups to get their records out in America. And you know, as of course, when you start a label, you know, the first thing that happens is other people start coming to you and you start looking at American acts. And I quickly discovered that American acts couldn't get record deals in either. You know, I mean, the Go-Go's couldn't get a record deal, for instance. So all of us, you know, as IRS grew, we began to pick up American acts as well. Wall of Voodoo, Oingo Boingo, you know, one after another, you know, and of course a lot of British acts. So the label was you know, the start of it really was in England, and it was an offshoot of England, but it became, you know, once the Go-Go's went to number one, IRS became, you know, the happening label of probably of the 80s, you know, and with the Go-Go's going to number one, it was actually the biggest selling album of the year in the country, which was, you know, a hell of a thing. And of course, it was the first time an all-girl group had ever had a number one record in America. You'd had number one singles, you know, the Supremes and whatever, but no girl group had ever had a number one album. So we were the first. And, of course, you know, it was our number one as well, and at IRS Records. And so it really put the label on the map.
I'm curious, Miles, when you first brought that deal to A&M America, Jerry Moss, who was responsible for the marketing at that point?
A&M was, but I had the when I had went to the company, I figured I had already had some experience with them. I had had Squeeze touring America once, and met some of the representatives in the company, and the ones that were really keen were the young, unpaid college reps, what they called. They had like 28 college reps around the country. It was sort of an intern program where you had these young kids who wanted to enter the record business, and they A&M had this sort of college department, and I think they might have paid them, you know, free records and a little bit of $20 here, $20 there or something. But basically they were unpaid. And I figured, well, those are guys that are young, they're into what I'm doing, and that's like free marketing team, you know. They'll going to, I mean, I was hoping to get on college radio stations, you know. I was hoping to get, you know, the little independent record stores and places where if you weren't a big honcho in a record business, you know, you probably wouldn't go to those places anyway. You know, it would be the college kids that would do it. So I thought A&M had this great operation already that would help me, you know. And some of their people were kind of intrigued with the whole punk thing, and they'd seen the Police doing well, and they were thinking, well, you know, maybe some of these other things might do something, you know. But most people wrote it off and thought it was pretty minimal, you know. But I think about a month after I'd done the A&M deal, A&M closed the college department. So I lost all those kids that I thought was going to be helping me. So I decided I better hire a couple of them, and I hired a guy named Jay Boberg here in L.A., and I hired a girl in New York who had been the local rep in New York, and a couple others, you know, that I had sort of met on the road. But, of course, I had no money, so my deal with Jay was, look, Jay, I don't have any money to give you, so I'm going to pay you $100 a week, but I'll make you vice president of the label. So here's this college kid who, you know, was still in college and, you know, $100 a week. I mean, if it was a real job, he wouldn't have taken it, you know. But the reality is if he had asked me for, you know, $50,000 a year salary or something, I would have said, well, sorry, I can't afford you. Goodbye, you know. But he accepted it. But I think the hook was that I offered him vice president, you know, to be vice president of a record label at age 20, you know,
yeah,
or 21, whatever. I think it was enough of a hook that he thought, well, how bad could it be? And I think he believed in the music, and, you know, as did some of the other people I was working with. So I basically started the label on a shoestring, mainly because I could. And, of course, that nobody was paying attention to the music, so everybody thought it was a joke. I mean, I think Billboard actually had an article after a week or two after the label started saying punk is dead in America, you know. So it was a situation where, you know, nobody was taking it very seriously, and I didn't make it hard for them to enter the business because I said, well, it's free, you know, and so people said, yeah, you know.
Miles, where is the turning point on that in terms of the acceptance of punk?
I don't think it really was until the Go-Go's happened, which was a couple of years later. I mean, a lot of people don't know this, but after the first year of IRS Records, Jerry Moss called me into his office, and he said, Miles, you've been doing this for a year. You put out 8 records. None of them been a hit. So let's just close the label. It was over.
Wow.
And I said, well, Jerry, did you make money in the year? And he said, well, yeah, I made money, but, you know, it was nothing to write home about, you know. I mean, it was a $20,000-$30,000 profit or something, okay? Which to an A&M at that time was a joke, you know.
Yeah.
Well, any major label, $20,000 would have been, you know, dropping a bucket, you know. And I said, yes, but how many times in your career have you made money in the first year of doing a project? And he said, well, I probably never. And I said, well, you did with me. He said, well, you're right, you know. And so I basically talked him into giving me one more year, you know. And I said, look, Jerry, give me another year. And he did. He says, okay, what the hell? Because, again, it was a situation where it was costing him no money. You know, I was not pressuring him to saying, why aren't you putting this record? Why aren't you doing that? Why aren't you, you know, it was pretty easy, you know. Well, by the end, you know, somewhere along in that second year, of course, the Police exploded in England. They became the biggest group in the world outside the United States. I mean, the record, the second album in England, the first album didn't really do very much, okay? Second album went straight to number one. We had 3 number one singles. It went to number one in Holland, number one. It was huge. It was a mega group around the world, okay? And so, you know, you're selling millions of albums, and I think by, you know, deep into the second year, I, as a manager, the Police, you know, Squeeze was doing pretty well, and it was like, well, you know, IRS is not really costing us any money, and so, and the Police are doing so well and whatever, you know. So the second year came and went. Jerry Moss never called me into his office. So I wasn't going to go knock at his door and say, oh, by the way, Jerry, the year's up. What are you going to do? You know, so it was in the beginning of the third year that the Go-Go's records, you know, I signed the Go-Go's, and their records started taking off. And within that third year, the Go-Go's record went to number one. And everybody then woke up and said, well, wait a minute, maybe something really is going on here. And I think that was the time, really, that IRS, as a record company, started, you know, people were taking it seriously. Because remember, the Go-Go's, aside from the fact that there was every label that rejected them because they were girls, they didn't really look upon IRS as a big deal because, you know, we were a Mickey Mouse label that never had a hit, you know. But we were the only game in town, so they signed to us. And, you know, I know when I signed them, where I went to the manager and said, look, let's make a deal. She said, great, okay. She then went off to a bunch of the record labels again and saying, okay, IRS has made us a deal. Do you want to get in? And, of course, every label still rejected her. So she gets a meeting with a group and says, look, there's only one person who's interested, and it's this Miles Copeland crazy guy at IRS Records, and that's the only deal there. What do you want to do? And the girl said, well, let's do it. And luckily for me and for them, we did it. And the Go-Go's went out on IRS Records, and inch by inch, it climbed the charts. And we had this young college kid who I had just hired to join the company a few months back, who was, again, one of the college reps. His name was Michael Plenn, and he was this little bulldog that would just not take no for an answer. He used to call himself the attack hamster. I think he would go to record labels, he would go to radio stations, and he would say, look, I'm not going to leave here until you agree to play the record. And I'm convinced that a lot of those radio stations, they agreed to play the Go-Go's just to get Michael Plenn out of their place, you know, and they kept playing it to keep it from coming back. So, you know, it was one of these stories where, you know, when I look back at IRS and I said, what was really the ingredient that made the record happen? Well, of course, it was the music, you know. It was the work that I was doing and Jay and the key people in the company. But the real guy that was just this hound dog, this guy that was push, 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 was Michael Plant, who took that Go-Go's record to number one. Because when that went to number one, everybody woke up and went, oh my God, you know, this punk stuff, it's real, you know. Biggest record of the year, you know. Girls can play. This, you know, so the next thing we know, we were the happening label in America.
You can hear part two of my interview with Miles Copeland on the podcast next week. You can also find out more about Miles at milescopeland.com. It's Miles Copeland, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, to listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.